Thanks to all of you for being here, and thanks to the organizers for giving me the chance to talk. I'm pleased to tell you a little bit about some work I've been doing for a while now. I'd like to give sort of an overview of this work. It's work that's been going on in various different papers with various different collaborators. Here's kind of an incomplete list. So I'd like to start by giving thanks also to all of them for various ideas and conversations and papers that we've written together. And also to those of you in the audience who I've talked with. I've learned a lot from very many people over the course of the last few years. What I'd like to do is give some sort of impression of what we've been thinking on, what we've been thinking about, and sort of how I feel that the things we've been thinking about fit together. It'll be sort of like a bird's eye perspective, and we'll see if I can manage to do that in 25 minutes. And I'd like to sort of sum that up or orient you a little bit by giving a list of four slogans, which maybe you can keep in mind over the course of the talk. These are vague, probably not understandable the way they're written. But here they are. So superspace geometries like almost complex geometry, importantly not complex geometry, but almost complex. Theories are like their twists. Symmetries and deformations belong together. And higher dimensional current algebras are worth thinking about. And so these are slogans that are sort of perhaps a bit surprising at first glance. And in particular, there's sort of obvious ways in which some of these aren't true. For example, there are many ways in which a theory is not like its twists. A twist might be a topological theory, it might be holomorphic, captures only some BPS part of the theory, the dynamics are simpler. And so I'd like to sort of tell you what I mean by each of these and how they sort of fit together in my mind. And in particular, that'll involve telling you what I mean by the word like. There's sort of a precise sense in which this metaphor, or probably my middle school English teacher would tell me this is a simile, the way in which this simile or metaphor is supposed to work. And lest you think this is sort of an abstract perspective which is just at the level of some interpretive thing or just about a sort of way that I happen to enjoy thinking about quantum field theory, I'd like to sort of make the case that it has some concrete applications. And so at the end of the day, I'd like to arrive at the special example, which is listed here. By thinking about sort of the geometry of 2, 0 superspace in 6 dimensions from the perspective I'll describe, you can write down an object, it's a higher current algebra, and it's closely related to the conformal supergravity multiplet. There's a chiral algebra associated to that object. This is the construction of Beam, Aristotelian and van Ries, and the corresponding chiral algebra is W2, or Virasoro currents. If you took the holomorphic twist, which is the sort of other truncation of this object that you could write down, you get something which is closely related to the exceptional super Lie algebra E36. This was a thing that's written down by Katz. And I'll try to make the case that those three objects are, in a sense, instances of the same thing, or are similar to one another in the way that a theory and its twists are similar. This object governs both superconformal symmetry of type 2, 0 in 6 dimensions and moduli, meaning deformations of 2, 0 superspace. And if you take this object and you reduce it to 5 dimensions at the holomorphic level, so working with the object E36, you get something that agrees with the holomorphic version of SU2, Maxwell Super Young Mills theory. So this is something which, if you're interested in the physics of 5 brains, ought to perhaps make your ears perk up a little bit. But I'm gonna have to start, so I'll go in order, and I want to sort of start by telling you about the thought process that leads you to this particular construction, or this particular guess. And that sort of follows from this analogy. So let me start by telling you a few things that you certainly already know, and I'll build up from there. So I want to think a bit about sort of questions that were around a lot more in the 80s or 90s than they are today about the geometry of superspace. There was sort of a great desire, I think about supersymmetric theories as being defined on some sort of supermanifold. And that supermanifold, as you know, everybody's written this down many times, I think, in this audience. It's characterized by its algebra of functions, which have not only commuting coordinates, but also some anti-commuting ones, usually called thetas. Normally, those are some spinor variables, but that's not actually essential for me, at least at the beginning. It's just some supercommutative algebra. And it's important that it has one additional structure. That additional structure is basically the set of odd translations. Those odd translations are implemented by odd vector fields. And those odd vector fields fail to commute because they sort of implement the idea that supersymmetry acts locally, and supersymmetry is, of course, not commutative. Two odd translations should commute to an even translation. And so to state that in a coordinate free way, there's sort of a non-integrable odd distribution. That means an odd subbundle of the tangent bundle of this space. It has maximal dimension, and it fails to be integrable. Non-flat space, these are just the formulas that people have seen many times. You can act by the left or on the right, and so you get the typical formulas for Q and D. Now, the way I'd like to think about this is that an almost complex structure is specified by very similar data. If I have a manifold, which is just a real manifold, and I think about its complexified tangent bundle, one way to tell you what an almost complex structure is to tell you which tangent vectors are of type 0, 1, are sort of in the anti-holomorphic part of the tangent bundle. And that's precisely just some distinguished subbundle of the tangent bundle. And if it's integrable, so if it's a normal complex manifold, the torsion vanishes, meaning that commutators of anti-holomorphic vector fields are still anti-holomorphic. Of course, I'm interested in the case where that condition fails, so I'm interested in really genuinely almost complex structures. But anything that I can define for an almost complex manifold, it has an analogous thing. There's an analogous construction that I can write down in superspace. And so it'll be sort of just fun to see what those are. For example, if I wanted to think about a complex manifold in terms of the functions on it, and this is sort of, it's probably intuitive to everyone that this is what one should do, the smooth functions, which in this analogy are the things generated by all the x's and all the thetas, they're not really the right things to think about because they're not structure preserving. With respect to this extra structure, I really want sort of the holomorphic things. And if the manifold were complex, how could I sort of start just from this subbundle and get back to the holomorphic functions? Well, I could take all the differential forms. It's easy to write those down. I could weight them, and in my conventions, that'll mean I give dz's weight -1 and dz bars weight 0. Then the Durand differential splits up into pieces of different weight. There's a piece of weight 0 called del bar. The thing in weight minus k in these conventions consists of k comma star forms equipped with the del bar differential, and that's an object whose cohomology is basically telling you about holomorphic k forms, and in particular in weight 0 about holomorphic functions via the Dolbeau resolution. Now you'll complain because that doesn't quite work if this is not an actual complex structure, if it's not integrable. But it turns out that there's a good generalization of that construction in the almost complex case. What happens there is that the Durand differential consists not just of del bar and del, but it splits up into four pieces. Those four pieces consist of del bar and del, together with a tensor, this is the well-known Neihaus tensor, which encodes the failure of the distribution to be integrable. It tells me, if you like, locally at each point, about the failure of the commutators of anti-holomorphic vector fields to be purely anti-holomorphic. And that's, I mean, the notation gamma is suggestive. That's similar to what the supertranslation algebra is telling you in superspace. It tells you that locally over each point, you expect odd things to anti-commute to even things via structure constants, which are the gamma matrices, or at least built out of gamma matrices. So del bar is no longer square zero, but it does square to zero up to terms which are exact for gamma. And so in a sense, what I can do is I can first pass to the cohomology of gamma. Think of this as imposing some torsion constraints in sort of old superspace language. Then I get an object where del bar does act, and I can write down the analog of what holomorphic functions should be. And that's sort of a thing we could try to do to understand superspace. This is not the way you would maybe start out to try to do it, but if you sort of pretended that you didn't know anything about superspace and you took this analogy seriously, this is the sort of thing you would try to do. And so you might ask, what are holomorphic functions? And also, what are holomorphic vector fields? Those are the objects that control symmetries of a complex manifold. So it's natural to ask what they look like. And in particular, when I say holomorphic vector fields, I really am taking sort of the perspective that the sheaf of holomorphic vector fields has some higher cohomology, which consists of deformations of complex structure. They sort of appear naturally there in the first cohomology of this thing. That'll come back later. That's sort of the third theme. But that's actually, it's a prescription for how you should compute an object that's just associated to superspace. So let's just do this and see what happens. This is a slightly more technical slide. I just write down the Durand forms on superspace. There are fermionic objects called dx mu. There are bosonic objects called d theta a. There's a Durand differential, but in order to think about what I'm doing in terms of this weight decomposition, I need to work with respect to left invariant one forms, which is a frame basis, not a coordinate basis. And in that basis, the Durand differential actually looks like what's written here. I think this is a laser. Yes, it is. So this first piece, which in this analogy is gamma, is nothing other than the structure constants of the supersymmetry algebra. del bar is something which, if you've ever seen the pure spinner superfield construction, is exactly the BRST differential that people write down there. And I want to emphasize that this just sort of fell out. We didn't put this in. Consists of the derivative called dA contracted with the one form lambda A. That's like a d theta A if you want. And that's not of square zero, but it is of square zero if the product of two lambdas is zero. So it squares to zero up to the pure spinner constraint. It's exactly what we thought. Del itself is just the bosonic Durham differential. And there's no gamma bar. In fact, it's a little bit easier than the complex case. And that object is going to be some sheaf or some collection of objects on superspace, and it turns out to be a supermultiplet, which is, in each case, one that you've seen before. If you plug in the structure constants of the type 2b supersymmetry algebra in 10 dimensions, for example, you find the type 2b supergravity multiplet with a big collection of ghosts and, in fact, also anti-fields. You get an object which represents, on shell, precisely the field content of linearized type 2b supergravity. And it's well known in most of these examples. So I think all of these, maybe except 2 comma 0 and these weird examples, are known in the literature, in particular in work of Berkowitz. A lot has been said about this 10 to n equals 1 example. But I want to emphasize that we know a little bit more now, because we constructed not just the holomorphic functions on this space, but we constructed all of the holomorphic k-forms. And so we know what it means to assign a complex dimension to superspace. Complex is in scare quotes here. Anytime I use a word referring to complex geometry, it'll be in some kind of scare quotes. The complex dimension just means the largest number such that the k-forms, the holomorphic k-forms, are non-trivial. That's what it would mean on a complex manifold. We also know what it would mean to be Kolebiau, because to be Kolebiau means that the sheaf of holomorphic top forms is the same as the sheaf of functions. It's trivializable, because that's what a Kolebiau form would do. It would be a non-vanishing section of that bundle. And so I've given just sort of a list of what happens here. I want to emphasize that, like, if you want to know, if you wanted to check the entries in this table, you could write down the structure constants of the corresponding supersymmetry algebra, you could put them into your computer, and it would be a matter of a few minutes to recover the field content of these multiplets. You'd have to work a bit harder to figure out the BRST differential, but that's also an output rather than input. And some of these numbers are sort of surprising. So like 11-dimensional supergravity here is, from this perspective, something which is a Kolebiau 2. And 6-dimensional 2 comma 0 supersymmetry, where I get the abelian tensor multiplet, that's something which is a complex curve, as complex dimension 1. So I've told you what I mean by those remarks, but why did I pick these particular non-standard examples? Well, you'll notice that there's actually one non-standard example in the examples 2 comma 0. There's a non-standard example below it. And 10 to 2 comma 0, there's a non-standard example below it. In 11 dimensions, there's a non-standard example below it, and they have the same properties. So it's another Kolebiau 2. That's another complex curve. That's also another complex curve. Well, the reason for this is that nothing in the construction I give you depended on the fact that it was a standard supersymmetry algebra. I could take any supersymmetry algebra built out of odd generators and even generators with some bracket that I write down by hand, I could apply this construction. It didn't depend on that being a spinner. And so that means, in particular, if I look at twists of supersymmetric theories, I can compute the supersymmetry algebra of residual supersymmetries. That means those things that commute, I fix a square zero q, I look at things that commute with that square zero q, modulo things that are exact for it under Lorentzian R symmetry, then I'll get an algebra of residual supersymmetries, which is sometimes non-abelian. And in fact, those three examples are the algebras of residual supersymmetries in the holomorphic twists of 2, 0, 11-dimensional, and type 2b. And the reason I put those there is to emphasize that the structure is the same. To sum up what I mean by this, or to maybe justify for you that it's reasonable, I would say that if you think about a theory which is formulated in superspace, just on flat superspace, and you think about what it means to take a twist, well, for me, that means I want to look at the invariance of a supercharge, right? Because the supercharge is odd, to take invariance means to pass to its cohomology. But that's, in a very precise sense, an analog of dimensional reduction. So if I were to take the dimensional reduction with respect to an even translation, I would take the invariance of that generator. If I take an odd direction, I'd take the invariance of that generator. That's taking Q cohomology. That's imposing some BPS condition. And in superspace, those things are kind of on the same footing, because both of those are just acting geometrically. And we're very used to statements that say, okay, if I have a 4D n equals 1 theory and a 2D 2, 2 theory, they're related by dimensional reduction, so in some sense they're structurally similar. It's not surprising that one is sort of governed by the same types of terms that the other is. And so you can sort of intuitively expect the same in superspace, at least to some extent. And one formulation of this point is something that I figured out together with Brian Williams, which says that if you apply the construction that I've been talking about before, so if you work out the multiplet that sort of is analogous to the structure sheaf, analogous to the holomorphic functions in superspace, that construction commutes with twisting. So if you take the holomorphic functions on a superspace and then you twist that multiplet, you pass to the BPS sector with respect to a specific square zero supercharge, you could have taken the same supercharge, looked at the cohomology in just the super Poincaré algebra, computed the residual supersymmetries, then applied the same construction to that. The order doesn't matter. And so that means that those algebras that I wrote down before, those are governing theories that are in fact the twists of the untwisted partner theories. And as a corollary of that, you can check, for example, that the twist of type 2b supergravity is related very closely up to some issue about potentials to free minimal BCOV theory. You can do that in 5 minutes. So it's really, really something very computationally effective. And it's not just about the free theories. So like here's a sort of catalog of some results. Most of these are in the literature somewhere. So Beaulieu showed that if I look at holomorphically twisted 10D superyang mills, I get a holomorphic Trin-Simons theory on C5. Nathan Berkowitz, following I guess a suggestion by Schwartz and Witten, or at least this is what it says in his paper, checked that the holomorphic Trin-Simons action on superspace, so for holomorphic functions of the type that we just described, is also 10-dimensional Super-Yang-Mills theory, but untwisted. So there's some suggestions about how this should work for supergravity, in particular for 11-dimensional supergravity. One expects, in the maximally twisted version, a Poisson Trin-Simons theory on C2 times R7. In fact, Martin Sutterwell wrote down a pure spinner action for that theory, which you can show is in fact nothing other than a Poisson Trin-Simons type theory on superspace. This is recent work with Fabian Hanner. And so in that sense, really, the three theories, 11-dimensional supergravity and its two twists, they're theories of the same type. They all describe a theory on a Calabi-Yau twofold of some kind, where the interactions come from the holomorphic Poisson tensor, which is just the Calabi-Yau form. So that's like nice on an interpretational level. It gives you some very compact way of describing these theories, and it relates them to superspace geometry in a way that people in the 80s probably would have found very pleasing. But I want to emphasize that sort of what we're doing here is not just about something interpretational. What might happen sometimes is that you have a little bit more structure in this description than you would in just some component field description that you write down. And sometimes you might also have an example where you know something about the twisted theory, but you're not sure how to write it down in the untwisted theory. This gives you a guess for what you should do. You should sort of try to formulate the twisted theory in terms of complex geometry, and then write the same thing down in superspace. It's the natural guess. So as an example of the first kind, let me just point out that when you formulate 11-dimensional supergravity in this way, it's naturally equipped with a two-shifted Poisson algebra structure. And that's exactly the sort of thing you'd expect on the observables of something that comes from a three-dimensional world sheet theory. So that's, if you like, a piece of structure that points sort of concretely towards some membrane theoretic type origin. It's totally analogous to the Leon Zuckerman bracket that you see in string theory. Or if you like twisted holography, this is similar to the way that the BCOV interaction arises in the B model. But I'm sort of going to be interested in the second kind of thing. There's a strong expectation that if I take the SLN type 2, 0 theory, this is the theory on a stack of NM5 brains, up to the zero mode. Beamer-Stelly and Van Rees showed that out of that theory I can pull some chiral algebra, which I expect to be WN. WN is the standard WN algebra, which is generated by currents of spin 2, 3, blah, 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 up to n. And they write in a way which I think is kind of prescient. The structure of the computable correlators may hold some clues about the right language with which to describe two comma zero theories more generally. So I'd like to spend the last few moments here arguing that that's in fact close to being the case. To do that, I need to tell you a little bit about the other object. So we computed, if you like, the sheaf of holomorphic functions, but not holomorphic vector fields. That's going to be the sort of thing that controls symmetries and deformations of the superspace that we wrote down. And if, again, this is just something I can plug into my computer, and I can ask what field content with what supersymmetry transformations pops out of this machine. And what happens is that you get the conformal supergravity multiplet. That really doesn't depend on the dimension or the amount of supersymmetry. You just get something which looks like conformal supergravity. And here's the result for 2, 0. So in degree 0, this has, by the way, I should say, canonical Lie algebra structure, or DG Lie algebra structure. In degree 0, you'll notice that there are vector fields, spinners, and zero forms valued in what I've called add R, that's SO5 R symmetry transformations. And if you looked at the cohomology in degree 0, you'd find exactly the superconformal algebra. You'd find those vector fields which are superconformal. And in degree 1, you see things that look like deformations of that. So you see a traceless deformation of the metric, up to diffeomorphisms, and so on. And you see a bunch of auxiliary fields here. Those auxiliary fields are, in fact, exactly the thing that was written down by Eric Bergshoff and Sezgin and Van Prooyen. This is a long time ago now. This object is the thing I was calling E36, and while it looks like it's just in degree 0, remember that this is really holomorphic vector fields. So in degree 1, that's going to have deformations of complex structure, something like Beltrami differentials in it. Here again, something similar. So in degree 0, this is a holomorphic SP1 transformation now, so SU2, that's the residual R symmetry in the twist. In degree 1, I would find a deformation of that structure, so a 1 form that looks like a deformation of a holomorphic connection in that bundle. So in a sense, the symmetries and the deformations are always appearing together. And it's automatic that if I take that thing and I find a square 0 supercharge and I twist it, I get this thing. I don't have to check anything. So what do you want to do with these objects? Well, we just constructed some family of what I'll call local Al-Infindi algebras. Just think about them as local expressions on the spacetime that tell you about symmetries and deformations of some object. In this case, these are really the objects that are telling you about the symmetries and deformations of superspace itself. And if you have some superconformal theory, this is the object that naturally couples to it. This is the thing over which it wants to be a family. It has an action of superconformal transformations, and a deformation of the metric into a different conformal class determines a deformation of the theory. So there's a really great sort of systematic machine for dealing with objects like this, due to Costello and Gwilliam in their book. And they construct an algebra, what they call currents, which is associated to any such local set of symmetry transformations. And they prove a version of Noether's theorem, which says if you have a field theory that has a symmetry by such an object, then there's a map from the currents of that symmetry into the observables of the theory. And you should think of this also as being related to higher form symmetries in a way that's, you know, we've talked a lot about higher form symmetries. The way you would say it in this language is that a global symmetry, really a global symmetry is something that you should implement in locally, right? In field theory, everything is local. So it's a local symmetry with a local constraint that says that it's locally constant. And then it looks like a differential form valued in that Lie algebra, and that also has higher cohomology. And that, so in particular, the first cohomology is something like a flat bundle. It tells you about coupling to a flat background. This is saying that these constructions are, in a sense, similar to the ways you would think in two-dimensional theories. There, it's quite common, thanks, to think about current algebras. What I want to make clear, though, in the last 45 seconds is that once you've done this, you have an object which has 2, 0 supersymmetry. It's a current algebra, it's not described by a least action problem, and it controls the moduli problem of deformations of 2-0 superspace. It twists automatically to W2, so it satisfies Beeman-Rastelli's conjecture on the nose. What's not automatic is that this thing reduces to 5D Super-Yang-Mills theory. And I'll just show you quickly what that map looks like. So if I reduce E36, I'm working at the holomorphic level now, I have generators that look like vector fields on C2 times R together with an extra generator coming from the third complex direction. If I took the holomorphic fields of Yang-Mills theory, they'd look like this. And there's a totally explicit map of the observables you can write down that sends these linear generators of the current algebra that we wrote after dimensional reduction to the quadratic gauge invariant observables of holomorphic n equals 2 super Yang-Mills theory. And you can sort of already see that actually this is better than a match of indices. It in particular includes a match of indices. But if you think about Poisson brackets of these things, sort of like schematically remembering the way that duals work, alphas conjugate to beta and phi 1 to phi 2, you can see that the Poisson brackets of these objects reproduce the Lie brackets of the Lie algebra E36. So there's a lot to do. There's a question about central extensions, which I won't say anything about. There are many open questions, I think also related to Edward Frenkel's talk. It'd be interesting to have some geometric perspective on how to do higher versions of this. And there's a lot I could tell you about that, but I'm out of time. So let me just thank you for your attention. And
yeah. One or two brief questions.
Hi, thanks for the great talk.
Thanks.
I was wondering if you also have a similar geometric interpretation for harmonic superspace?
I have at least a vague one. So I tend to think about harmonic superspace as one way of thinking about what pure spinners are doing. It's not the way I showed you, but it's a different way to think about it, is that you can imagine implementing chiral constraints in a family. So if you wanted to take the cohomology of some chiral operator d alpha, that's the sort of thing you'd do to impose a chiral constraint like in 40 n equals 1. If you took every square zero d and you implemented all of those constraints in a family over the space of square zero d's, you'd get the pure spinner thing. And I sort of think of harmonic superspace as basically taking an extended theory in 40, for example, thinking about it with respect to an n equals 1 subalgebra, and then doing that globally over the space of n equals 1 subalgebras of n equals 2. I don't know if that's a useful interpretation, but that's how I would think about it.
I was just wondering if this can somehow be used to discover superspaces for higher dimensional, for like n equals 2, n equals 4, SUSY, which off-shell superspaces, which might not be known, somehow by working by analogy.
Yeah, so you can you can prove a theorem, in fact, which says that this thing, this is an equivalence of categories in a certain sense. This is work with Connor and with Chris Elliott. So if you have a theory that has supersymmetry transformations in a precise sense, meaning that you formulate it either in BRST or BV, and you write closure terms that mean that the supersymmetry closes up to corrections for either the gauge invariances or the equations of motion of the theory. If you present it in that way, then there's a unique object which you can think of as a sheaf over the pure spinner space, which determines that multiplet and vice versa. So there's a way of going back and forth between those constructions. For n equals 2, it works great. When you go to higher dimensional examples, so in particular if you go above 11 dimensions, what you find is that there are too few even translations with respect to odd translations, and that means that the algebraic geometry of the space becomes less interesting. So there's kind of a perspective you can find on supersymmetric theories, which says the reason they exist in the spaces where they do is that that's the only set of examples where there are interesting holomorphic functions. Otherwise, the only holomorphic functions are constant.
Maybe time for one more brief question.
Davide has one, maybe.
Not, oh, yes, David.
Well.
Can you elaborate a bit on this E3 structure in 11-dimensional supergravity?
Yeah, like specifically about the Poisson structure?
Yes, so as you're saying, it's indicative of some kind of a membrane description, but...
So, I mean, I think one thing that you get from these... one way of saying what that structure is that the... Because it's sort of a BV-type version of things, the interactions are described by some Lie bracket or L-infinity structure. The new piece is actually the commutative structure. And you would expect a commutative structure if it were first quantized, because then the fields of the theory should be some kind of observables on the in the world sheet theory, and they have a commutative product. And so in a sense, this makes that commutative product obvious, and it shows you that the commutative product and the interactions together satisfy some Poisson relation or shifted Poisson relation. And the reason the shift is two is that, I mean, you know this thing very well, that if you have a topological theory in D plus one dimensions, then you have some D shifted Poisson gadget. So it's a three-dimensional world sheet theory. You get a shift by two. And you would expect that sort of the higher operation that that comes from the class where you take descendants and integrate them around a point, that that's sort of giving you the interactions in some sense. I don't know how to write the world sheet object that does that, but the fact that you have that algebraic structure is sort of is suggestive of the fact that it comes from that.
Well, can one write down a sort of a what the analog of a string field theory would look like based on E3 structures? It might be a question, but.
That's a great question. I mean, I don't know a general story that would tell you that. I mean, the sort of thing you would expect is that they are like, there's a question about the descendants, which I sort of don't have anything specific to say about like the gravitational descendants. At a very hand-waving level, the thing you would expect is that if you have a field theory and its shift by two has a commutative product, then that's a signal that it ought to be at least a part of some sort of membrane field theory, I would say. But I don't know a general, I don't know a better answer to that question, I don't think.
Okay, let us thank Ingmar very much again.